Yeah, somebody asked me about money. I do ask you to pay if you're not here. That's part of the deal. I don't know if they made that clear or not, but... Oh, well. That's why.
Because I thought you had said something about that people tend to drop out, but that's if they let you know ahead.
Well, if you decide not to come, I'm not going to hold you responsible for the...
Okay, I guess...
Duration of the class.
I see, that's where I got that.
Yeah. But if you're staying in and you miss, then I need to ask people to pay. Yeah, that's only fair, I think. Are you ready? Just a couple of housekeeping details. I figured out the schedule for the fall, and I printed it up so you've got it. Pass it around. Also, I'm going to add a sheet to the study guide, which I photocopied. It goes after page 36. I'll pass that around. I've got to ask whether this room is still free in the fall. I'll let you know. I just thought you might like to know about the dates in case you wanted to plan ahead. Yeah, one on the top and one on the bottom. The dates and the addition to the study guide. And if you're saying, gosh, I just can't get enough of Jungian psychology, I'm going to do another seminar on Saturday mornings. I'll pass that around if you want to take one. It's the Dream Analysis Seminar. It's a seminar Jung gave in English where he took one guy's dreams over the course of a year and showed the people in the class how he worked with the dreams. It's about the only place where Jung really talks nuts and bolts. As you see, we're working with archetypal material. That's what he writes about, but that is certainly not all the therapy is. There's, you know, a million other questions you have to be aware of. And in that volume, he at a very introductory level, talks about how he interprets dreams, how he deals with transference, how he what he says, what the guy says, what the guy's wife says. It's a very hands-on sort of course. Well, I think today I'll start off with a little review, and then I have some details left over from last time that we'll talk about, and then we'll move into the new material. Last time we continued, did you? No. Okay, they're coming. Last time we finished up our kind of introductory material. In which we looked at Sophia in thoughts, we looked at Sophia in images, dream images, and then we looked at Sophia historically. And we last time we touched on Sophia Gnosticism. If you remember, in Gnosticism, she was often described as the piece of God that at creation got trapped in the world. So she's trapped in the material world. So right away you've got this theme that we're working with, that the spiritual is trapped within the material. In other words, that the religious dimension is somehow hidden within the apparently secular events of daily life. We talked a little bit about how alchemy then worked with that idea, which was to extract that piece of the divinity in matter through a chemical procedure. We talked about it in terms of medieval philosophy, which understood that Sophia was the forms that God used to create the world, or if you put it in our language, the forms that we that our life is meant to fulfill. Then Carol talked about her beautiful painting, and she made several salient points. I think the thing I'd like to leave you with, at least, is that Sophia is pregnant. In other words, that is the part of the, I'll say, human personality, which is activated in the present moment and is behind many of the phenomena of our daily life. When you look at the hedonism and the desirousness and the power and the greed, that is her language. That's the way she's trying to come to consciousness. And that's pretty much what this course is about. How do you deal with that? What do you do about that? Remember what Jungian psychology is. It's looking at the processes in human beings through images, not through thoughts. In thoughts, you go from A to B to C. But the process that we work with are our dream images or fantasy images or mythological images, where a different method is required. And we don't go from A to B to C. We look at the image and we walk around it. We circumscribe. So it's a circular approach. And it's very easy to get confused, to want your linear mind to be engaged, when in fact what we're doing is a circular process. Some of you, this is old stuff. Some of you, this is maybe new stuff. The other thing I think that will help you immensely is if we kind of throw a sop to our linear mind, and we do that by always remembering what image are we working on. So even though the discussion may get way off in this circumambulation, it's always with an eye back to that central point, which is the image. So I introduced that I said that as an introduction to the fact that last week we talked about the south and the south wind. So that's the main image. And we'll just come back to that a little bit today, and then we'll move on to the next image. So if you get confused, and you probably will get confused because it's confusing material, this is why dream work is so hard. There's just so much that doesn't hold together rationally. But if you can flip your mode of apprehension into this circular process, and if you get stumped and you say, oh my God, what are we doing now? Just go back to that first image that we're working on. So I will always try to remind you, okay, here's the image. Here's the image. Here's the image. And we may go far off, but we should always have some way of realizing what the relationship is between what we're talking about and what that image is that we started with. So that's pretty much. Oh, the other thing we did, which we'll come back to a little bit, is because of the wind, we talked about the spirit. We defined spirit, and we'll come back to that today. Any questions so far, just on what we've done? Yeah.
One question, comment. I noticed in so much reading, and you just said it, that in better writing and older writing, the word apprehension is always used instead of comprehension. And young people nowadays, and I guess everybody here fits, we know what apprehension means.
Uh-huh.
But young people say, but apprehension means you're afraid, or apprehend means to take somebody in. And I said, not in the old sense of the word, get out your dictionary. I just wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, and well, and it emphasizes the work that's necessary for the understanding.
That's right.
Yeah. And this is work, as I'm sure you're discovering. Okay, some details that I wanted to follow up on. We got into that discussion, I think, two times ago about the destructive aspect of Sophia. And one of the images in the history of religious traditions which does show that the goddess of fate has a destructive aspect is in India, in the image of the goddess Kali. I brought along some pictures of Kali. You can see she's on the corpse of her victim, and in one she's got blood coming out of her mouth, so she's sort of a vampire. And Cal pointed up to us that von Franz has talked about that, and sure enough, it's even in the study guide. I didn't remember it. And that's, if you want to go back to the study guide, page 36. I did give a quote from Number and Time there. So I'll just read you. Just so not what we're doing, just taking that Sophia image and looking at it culturally a little bit. We don't get this in our Judeo-Christian image so much, but you do get it in other traditions. And if you go 6 quotes down, the god Shiva is the one she's standing on. Bor the title of Maha Kala, Great Time, or Kala Rundra, All Consuming Time. As Heinrich Zimmer remarked, Zimmer was a friend of Jung's who studied Indian mythology. Remarks, he symbolized the energy of the universe, the forms in which he revealed himself, eternally creating, preserving, destroying. That's the three qualities of Shiva. The personification of Shiva as time, now it gets to us, was later incorporated into another image, the goddess Kali, a word signifying the feminine form of Kala, time, who represented his activating energy, Shakti. With good reason, Hermann Gunther equates the word Kala with the Greek Kairos. Remember in the Bible when Christ says, my time has come, the Greek is Kairos, my Kairos has come. And Kairos means the right moment, as opposed to Kronos, which means the duration of time. So this philologist equates the word Kala with the Greek Kairos, and Kairos, in its original sense, means to attach the thread of a web together. So there you've got a link between the web and the destructive. In this sense, Kairos signifies the right order in time. And hopefully you can see how that fits in with Sophia. The association of Kairos with the goddess weaving time, if you put that in our psychological language, weaving the pattern of our fate, alludes once again, we must mention in passing, to the idea of a field in which meaningful connections are interwoven like threads of a fabric.
This is
So we're looking at Sophia as behind synchronicity. And that is largely a benevolent experience. But if there is a synchronicity supporting your real development, and you are identified with your false self, you'll feel that as threatening. That's what I think Kali represents. It's the destructive side of this concept of a real selfhood when you're identified with false selfhood. And I think there are runs of things going wrong, just like there are runs of things going right. And things go wrong when you're on the wrong path.
That, like weaving, perhaps?
It's a
warp and the loop?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So, just wanted to enlarge that a little bit. That we've got all that discussion, remember, with the spider?
Mm-hmm.
So I think Carol was right to have brought that up. Another image of the weaver, now just going cross-culturally, Carol pointed up to me. I thought I'd pass it around. In Native American traditions, there's the image of the spider woman. Pass that around. Same idea of a weaving. That there is something behind our lives trying to weave it into a meaningful pattern. Most of the time we experience that as a benevolent weaving. Remember the synchronicity of Pegasus that supported that woman. But sometimes it can be experienced destructively if we're on the wrong path. And just another detail, Kathleen sent me this email, which I thought I'd pass around. You want to tell about that? It's not exactly mythological,
no,
but it's interesting.
I was on a National Geographic website looking at some of the images from the Hubble telescope, and that caught my eye 2 or 3 years ago, and it has really stayed in the back of my mind. And then when Gary was talking about the double mandala, and Sophia, that just popped right back in. So I thought it was very important.
I'll pass it around. It's a picture of two galaxies, I think.
It's called, I think, an hourglass.
There's one galaxy.
Nebula.
It's a nebula.
Oh, it's nebula. What's a nebula?
What's left over after Stark's
Pond? Oh, okay. And it's a dual mandala with an eye in the middle. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was interesting that should appear.
Would that be where the object rather than...
That's where we're the object rather than the subject, which is the one of the real consequences of taking the superior material seriously, is that we try to look at ourselves through her eyes rather than just think we are the subject that always sees things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll be talking a little bit more about that. Another point left over, which I wanted to touch on partly and put on the back burner partly, because I'm trying to keep us somewhat on track, and we take quite a few detours as it is. Mm-hmm. So I just want to acknowledge a question which I didn't answer and give it a partial answer and then say we'll come back to it. That is, what does it, we talked about this idea of identifying with a part of the unconscious versus disidentifying from the part of the unconscious. And I said that what Sophia does is that she sends us these instinctual drives which lead us into these particular situations. And people naively think that what is at issue is a opportunity to fulfill a sexual drive or to fulfill a power drive, and to concretize those drives misses the point of Sophia, because she's just using those drives to communicate a pattern. Does that all sound familiar, I hope? And somebody said, so how do you do that?
What do you mean by concretizing? Do you mean by disregarding or going ahead and...
To concretize by going ahead and fulfilling the desire.
Making it real.
Generally, very often it's not clear. And the best you can do is try it. And then maybe you get burnt and you realize, oops, this wasn't meant to be. Or it becomes a beginning of a satisfactory relationship or a new job or something. And you realize, well, it was okay. Sometimes you can see in a dream it is not meant to be. And then what do you do with that desire? And the distinction which Jung has introduced, which is makes this so helpful, it's a path halfway between acting on the instinct or repressing the instinct, is serving the instinct, serving that thing. Give you an example, a classic example, which I thought is just also cute. Von Franz mentions that as a youngster, she... was fascinated with this image of the vagabond. And so as a young kid, she kind of left home and hopped on trains and just rode all around Europe enjoying a vagabond lifestyle. And got deathly sick, got pneumonia, came home. This was, of course, before much medication was around, and really had a very bad time of it. And realized that she could no longer be a literal vagabond. But she said, I had to satisfy that vagabond desire some way. So I realized I could be a vagabond in the spirit, and everything I write go against the church theologically. So you take that instinct, you take that image, you take that desire, and you serve it on a different level. You don't literally act it out. You take its metaphorical significance, and you find what place in your life that can be used, and then you put it into being. So that's how we try to work with this desirousness when it either can't be or shouldn't be literally satisfied. Then we try to take it as a metaphor and in some way incorporate the symbolic equivalent, a deed which is the symbolic equivalent of that instinct, into our life. That brought us into a discussion with, here's the part I want to put on hold, but I do want to pass this back to Tom, because he raised a question about it. She has that back. I suggested that when this Sophia material is, Tom Healy, yeah. When this Sophia material is knocking on our door, and I suggested it began knocking on our door around 50, 1880, 1900 in there. Another way to say that is as the projections onto the old God image were withdrawn, that no longer became the focus of religious experience. And Nietzsche, and we talked about Van Gogh, both observing that they don't find that old God meaningful anymore. Well, what happens then is the protection that belief system used to give against the onslaught of instinct is gone. And both Van Nietzsche and Van Gogh were probably the first two very articulate voices that got hit by that emotional intensity. And they had no way to understand it other than to try to live it out literally or burn up in it. And so they both went crazy. Now, I want to get back to Nietzsche and Van Gogh later, but let's not go there at the moment. I just wanted to observe, and I know there's an issue here of how this whole process had a historical background. Jung wasn't the first person to deal with this. Several other people dealt with it, Goethe as well. And these three people, we will when we have a little time later down the road, when we haven't, I think still we have some detours to take, we'll make a detour into that material and just look at how that all bears on it, sort of the historical background for this stuff, right? I want to at least give you kind of a rough and ready sense of when we say you're beset with intensity, well, what's the alternative? The alternative in our work, then, is to get a dream image for that intensity, for that instinct, for that desire, and then try to find out how we can serve that image, serve whatever that part of ourselves is, rather than just get consumed with the literal expression of whatever it is. And poor Nietzsche and Van Gogh just burn up in the desirousness. So that was another point I wanted to make. Thread I left hanging. John asked me, what's the relationship between Sophia and Lucifer? And I neglected to answer that question. The dreams of the devil are very interesting. Sometimes they are about what is flat-out evil. Sometimes they're about what you think is bad. And it's really not bad at all. I think I told you my Lucifer dream in divinity school.
I would love for you to give us an idea of how you interpreted that dream. You climbed up and up a ladder.
Yeah, I was in divinity school, and I was climbing up a ladder, and I got to the top, and I took one more step, and I fell off. And I started to fall, and I thought, oh, my God, this is the end. I'm going to die. And somebody caught me, put me down. I turned around and said, thank you. It was the devil. I said, thank you. The devil said, you're welcome. We went our separate ways. It's like the devil.
You mean the red devil?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, with the pitchfork. Oh, yeah.
He didn't want you to miss it.
He didn't want to miss it.
Okay.
Now, I don't think that was about evil. But I was in a theological institute. Everything is spirit. There's no room for instinct. Everything is good. There's no room for bad. And I was certainly caught up in that atmosphere. And I think, as Morton Kelsey said, any theological student who can get through three years of a theological training without a nervous breakdown has no moral integrity. So there I was up in all my theological theories, and I then fell into a real long period of hedonism, which I needed to get me out of that intellectual and spiritual position. So the devil wasn't evil. The devil was what that worldview considered bad. So I had to fall. I had to go through what was bad to get back to my heart. And interestingly, there's a whole story about that in antiquity. The gold mask by Apuleius, or Apuleius. And the hero falls into a den of robbers. And first he has to get initiated into the life of the robbers. In other words, recover his earthly instinctuality. And then he has to eat a rose. So he has to go into his instincts and then into his heart. And that's pretty much the path I had to take. Now, in, if you're looking at what Sophia asks of us, very often she's asking us to go into experiences that we think are bad. And there, I think, there's a link between Sophia and Lucifer. You could say, in a sense, that my falling into that hedonism was part of my Sophia path. You know, I had to recover my basic humanity by just living out instincts.
Did you have that dream prior to falling away, or during your falling away?
Kind of during, yeah.
During?
Yeah.
Maybe letting you know that you were not on the wrong path after all, okay?
And, yeah, and emphasizing the importance of what I was doing. And the pathology of the school, of the worldview I was working in.
Yeah, I was interested in that because of the root of Lucifer, meaning the bringer of
light. Right. So that...
Everybody looks at him as the bringer of darkness, but his name means it comes from...
So we've seen that these Sophia experiences, which we may think are wrong, remember the woman's affair, which are wrong, are the way to insight. And so that's the link, I think, between Lucifer and Sophia, if you see Lucifer not as a representative of the heart of darkness, but as the representative of experiences which are the shadow of the prevailing value system, which really, in fact, do hold promise of increased consciousness. Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking dualism rather than light and dark. Dualism. It's just almost like two sides of the same coin.
Right. A dance between the two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh.
One more. We are talking about spirit. But let me just mention two things I'm not going to talk about, which I will also talk about later. Mary raised the question, what's the relationship between the divine sparks in Gnosticism and the self? Hold that question. We'll come back to that. I do realize there's a question there, but I'm trying to keep us somewhat on track. The other thing I want to talk a little bit more about, which I'm going to postpone until later, is numinosity. So just so you can think of numinosity for the moment as awesomeness. That'll work as a synonym, but we'll get back to that later. Trying to keep the circle sufficiently broad, but not too broad. If you go to that page 36A, which I passed out, let's spend a little bit more time now weaving our way back to the assignment this week of... You didn't get one?
No.
I just passed them out.
Yeah, we got them. One of the 36 days.
Who didn't get it?
Marcy.
Oh.
I don't know how.
Oh, you got plenty.
Good. Thank you.
We were on the image of the wind and the south wind. And we talked about the wind as spirit. We talked about the south wind as the hot spirit. Namely, that the spirit, this directing experience, comes to us through hot emotional experiences. And that's the way the text starts. But I wanted to just look at the...
Didn't we also say that spirit, being soft and hot, is also desire?
Right, but that's what I meant to say. Right. That the overwhelming theme, which we'll come back to again and again in this material, is that there is such a thing as spirit. And we'll talk a little bit more about spirit. Namely, there is a non-ego intelligence, a non-ego guiding force in ourselves. But it no longer approaches us directly. It no longer comes down from heaven, so to speak. It comes up from the earth. It comes up to us through instinctual experiences. And I have a rough and ready list of what I mean by that, which I'll throw out. First of all, through synchronicity. Second of all, through desire. Thirdly, through the body.
all aspects of the life of the body. And fourthly, through disease. Disease in this sense is seen, some disease at least, as the last attempt of the spirit to communicate through creating an image in the form of a disease, or putting the other way around, a disease in the form of an image, which is to convey to you what your next step in life is. Give you an example. The classic example I saw was a woman whose husband was a workaholic. He was had a melanoma in the shape of the state of Florida, saying relax. That the physical body becomes an image through a disease, if you know how to read the disease symbolically. So those four dimensions are, there might be others, but that's kind of what I keep in the back of my mind as Sophia experiences, where the spirit is communicated. By far, the way most of us get it is through desire. I think that's the strongest megaphone.
What about the desire of everybody here to know more, to learn more about themselves?
That's not the way I was using the word desire. I was using the word desire.
You said physical.
Power and sex, basically.
Okay.
Power, sex, and acquisition.
Okay.
And usually she appears in those desires. She usually is in those desires when they are problematic. Not always. But see, she's trying to bust up our status quo. That's the Kali aspect. So, let's look at the spirit, 36a. It's from Number and Time, and I'll just read you her and Jung's, just elaborating not what we did last time. I thought this was such a good paragraph that it would help us understand the spirit a little more completely. So the spirit is that aspect of the soul that we call spirit, comprises above all the active, winged, animating, stimulating, inspiring components of the unconscious. That is, its dynamics. So, we'll come back to that sentence. But to get us started, the spirit is, you could say, a kind of drive. It's really not the right word. But to get us going, it's the activity within us, which is a spontaneous activity that's trying to create a life for ourselves from now to the future. It's a dynamism.
Is that the triangle and the square and the circle?
That's the triangle. And this is where Jung and Freud and Adler couldn't agree. For Jung, this dynamism is stronger than sex or power. He's not saying there's not such a thing as a sex drive and a power drive. He's saying that that doesn't comprise the total drives of the personality. There is another drive. It's not exactly, not quite a drive, but to use that word, which is this impulsion to create yourself, which is not something you do, but is being done within you.
It's constant.
It is constant.
The other ones are spread.
Right. It's always there.
It's autonomous.
It's autonomous. When the spirit is experienced as being a subjective component of an individual, we'll come back to that phrase too. You almost have to read this paragraph twice. It is also experienced as that, and this is the definition I gave you last week, but I used one incorrect word, so that's kind of what got me going too. revisit this. That factor which creates images in the inner field of vision and organizes them into a meaningful order. So it's what creates dream images, and it's what sees to it that when you've understood a dream image, the next dream image is a step ahead. We talked about that, right? Hope. That sounds familiar. And now, next sentence. The hallmarks of the spirit, says Jung, are firstly, the principle of spontaneous movement and activity. Secondly, the spontaneous capacity to produce images independently of sense perception. And thirdly, to Tom's word, the autonomous and sovereign manipulation of these images. In other words, the spirit manipulates the images. The spirit arranges the images in this sequence. This spiritual entity approaches primitive man from outside, but with increasing development, it gets lodged in man's consciousness and becomes a subordinate function. So what that sentence, last sentence, means is that this spirit was in earliest human consciousness projected outwardly. And... Sadie. Was projected outwardly, and so this activity was assigned to like fountain sprites or tree Newmans or ghosts. It was originally experienced outside, and only through the development of consciousness have we begun to realize that it's something within ourselves. Another way to put that is that God, as this spirit, was originally experienced outside, and now we are able to see that this function of creating our life is inside us. However, a large portion of spiritual phenomena persists untouched, however, in a natural state of autonomy, and can therefore still manifest itself as a breath-like presence that is a parapsychological phenomenon. So what she's saying is not all spirit is inside us. There is such a thing as the objective existence of whatever this thing is in the universe as well as in ourselves. And that would be very close to how some biologists look at the theory of evolution. The theory of evolution does not make sense from the point of view of strict Darwinian survival of the fittest. There are movements in the evolutionary development of the species which don't make sense with form equals function. And the development doesn't occur like this. It occurs like this, which does not make sense from his theory, as if there is something pulling us towards whatever we're becoming. And some biologists call that the spirit. So that this future creating dynamism is not only inside us, it's outside us, although a large amount of what we have seen outside of us is a projection. That doesn't mean that everything is a projection.
Discerning, that's the big key.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to get you a sense of how they're trying to really understand this. Now, another reason I wanted to go through this text, you see, when you are in touch with your spirit, then you feel alive. Addictions, you see, are a substitute for this spirit. Every addict I have ever known hated this when I told them about it. And many of them get up and leave therapy. They cannot stand the thought that something else is powerful in their lives and meant to lead them. And of course, they are backed up with the complete scientific worldview.
Yeah.
It's very, very tragic. And when you talk to an addict and you find yourself bored out of your skull, this is why. There is no liveliness. When you are working with this Sophia material and you are letting yourself be led by the Spirit, you get inspired. And people who are full of love and inspiration are full of love and inspiration because this is speaking to them. And when you are not filled with this, you go to the bottle for spirits. It's an exact relationship. So I wanted to go through this so you can see, so to speak, clinically what this amounts to. We're trying to help people become conscious of something which science as a whole denies, which the addictive nature of our culture abhors, but which is really at the center of a happy, bubbly, spontaneous, giving, loving, generative life. That's what it amounts to. And he gives such a nice set of descriptions of it that it's what makes people active. It's what makes people winged. It's what makes people animated. It's what makes talks stimulating as opposed to boring. It's what allows people to be inspiring. You know, why did Jung stay productive till he was 84? Because he had this inspiration in him through his relationship to the Spirit. So it's not, this idea of spirit is both a technical description of a drive, and it is also a qualitative descriptive of a personality. If you are dealing with the Spirit, you are inspired, same word, spirit in both, and you are inspiring. And you're an interesting person to be around. And it's what keeps you alive and not just turning into a golf idiot in Florida and in the last 20 years.
I want to ask a lot of questions.
Yeah.
When you refer to our non-ego and intelligence, you're referring to the subconscious,
right?
Yeah.
Right.
This is another way of saying it.
That it's not something you do. It's something that's in you, doing, and then you have to keep up with it. Yeah.
Tom. I have to bring this up. It sounds like a lot like a language of abuse. That things are constantly, in the language for the survivors, you know, they constantly express themselves saying things are constantly happening to them. And it's all pretty much, you know, bad. This relationship is a negative relationship to that. And I'm wondering, you know, how to break through that to come to a healthier relationship with the Sophia material so that that part of you feels threatened, which is the ego, and justifiably so, still nevertheless manages to surrender.
Tom, it's a very important question, and it's really the nuts and bolts of therapy. Mm-hmm. Because, now taking a step further, if you have been abused, or if you have had parents who are, you know, meanly authoritarian, what do you think you're going to feel when you meet the authority of the Spirit?
Mm.
All those feelings that you once experienced for that parent. I think that's the real crime of abuse, not that it doesn't have its own damage at the moment, but it leaves a residue that any creative activity on the part of the psyche is filtered through that old experience of abuse or authority. Because the Spirit may ask you for a sacrifice.
Right.
And will ask you for a sacrifice. And then what the response is to somebody who's been treated unfairly, what, I've been sacrificing all my life. I'm tired of this. But what they don't see is by giving a sacrifice to the Spirit, they're actually giving to themselves.
Mm.
And some people never make that transition. It's really sad to watch.
Can you give us an example of a sacrifice to the Spirit? I'm sure you can give us a million.
Giving up that relationship or giving up that job desire or giving up that fantasy to do this or that. Or conversely,
doing something you don't want.
Either giving up something you don't want to give up or doing something you don't want to do. Right. Because you, the response one gets back is, well, you know, people have been telling me what to do all my life. And now here you are, just like my parents, telling me what to do. Sometimes you can break through that, and sometimes you simply cannot break through that. And they're stuck. And they remain addicts.
I went the other day down to I'm a contractor, and I went down to a presentation at the factory down in Franklin, Indiana, Japanese-owned factory. And we met with three people from the factory to present a job to install some camera systems and stuff. And after it was over, the people I was with, I commented to me, and I said, you know, the thing that struck me about these three factory employees, they didn't have any spirit at all. Mm-hmm. You could tell they hated their jobs, they hated their lives. It's been the last 20 years in this factory. Mm-hmm. And it was just so evident, so obvious to sit across the table and watch their body, you know, language. And mm-hmm. Yeah, no spirit. It was gone.
That's really that's the tragedy of our time.
It's an abusive culture, the economics, the relationship to the natural environment, what we're doing to the planet, all of that.
If you think what an early society was, I mean, I lived in one when I was in the Peace Corps, how they arranged their social life around their festivals, but their festivals are expressions of their emotional needs. So their social calendar, their daily life, is organized around what they need for emotional satisfaction. Now, they're not terribly good farmers. They're not terribly good, it's changed now, but at that time, you know, you wouldn't want to buy one of their cars. But there was a happiness there, even though they were poor. And the tragedy of our industrial society is we have replaced the demands of the spirit with the demands of an industrial workplace. And it simply kills individuals. And what Jung was trying to do is give us some way to get back to that spirit.
Yeah, I think we have more freedom than we've ever had. I mean, I speak personally as a woman. I mean, I know if I lived in a tribe, I wouldn't begin to have the freedom I have now.
We have more freedom, but our souls are not as happy. That's the irony. Now, I'm not saying we should go back. I'm just trying to point out what we've lost, and then how can we recover it? And that's what Jung is trying to do, is realize this is a thing. And you know, again, look at those words in the first two sentences, and just apply those words to people you meet next week. See how many people are animated. How many people's... You see it in their bodies. Do their bodies move when they talk? What if you sit there like this? You can see it in many, many aspects of their personal demeanor, and that is a practical consequence of trying to understand what the spirit is. And as we've seen, the first words of this text, Sophia is a spirit. It's a hot spirit, or a spirit through heat. But I thought it might be worthwhile spending a little time on this, so you realize this is not just some abstract, conceptual, personality theory hypothesis. It is that also, but you can really see its effect in people's lives and in people's suffering lives. What is missing is this ability to allow that inner voice to lead them. And when they do, they just get happier. Maybe not happier, but more enthusiastic, more passionate, more caring. There's still pain, still a lot of pain. But you feel the game's worthwhile. I'm going to give it my best shot.
Do you think the several churches who use the term, and sometimes to open a prayer, Mother, Father, God, are pretty much on that path?
Well, I hope so.
They recognize the dwell.
The thing that worries me about the church is that it substitutes for the spirit. You go to church for a spiritual experience rather than find the spirit in yourself.
That was just something I wanted to throw out.
It doesn't mean it has to be that way.
No, I don't know. Somebody, let me throw something out. Somebody called me up with a bunch of political questions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I wonder how conservative I was. And I said I thought about an 8 on 1 to 10,
mm-hmm.
Which is a little high. Anyway, by the time I got through answering the question, she said, well, as a conservative, I think you're about 4.
Yeah.
And one of the things was, how frequently do you go to church? Like, weekly, monthly, blah, blah, blah. And finally I said, never. Just dead silent. Never. Never. Have you ever been to church? Yes. That's why I don't go. So I guess I don't know. I'm probably listed on, I think the Chamber of Commerce was doing that.
You're in trouble.
I'm a troublemaker.
You're in trouble.
I must tell you something that Carl Sandburg said that I just heard recently.
Oh.
And he was a very spiritual person.
Right.
He got one with nature. But he said he had no use for that churchianity.
Yeah, churchianity is on the side of building. It's really, you can be in church on nature.
Right.
You have a church every day.
Well, you know, my grandmother asked me one time, she said, you've never been baptized. And I said, no. She said, don't you think you should? And I said, why? She said, just in case. I said, you know.
Just in case.
She said, you love it. I'm over. I said, no. Every time I'm swimming. A river or a lake. I'm baptized. She said, okay. Good enough.
But I mean, don't you also think that there are some people who are churchgoers that fall into that category of being, you know, enthusiastic and happy? I mean, I do know some churchgoers.
I used to watch people come out of Catholic Mass with this beatified look on their face, clasping their hands, and I thought, okay, we just said the host and the thing, and how many hours is this going to last?
But I mean, people who are ongoing. I mean, I do know some people that are, you know, regular churchgoers, and thank God.
It doesn't have to be either or.
It's very odd.
It doesn't have to be either or.
It's okay.
Right. Yeah. Oh, it doesn't have to be either or.
Doesn't have to be.
Right. Levels. Everything.
In any case, we're just trying to find a way to help anyone who wants to find this spirit. Let's go back to the book then. I think we left off at 160. So that was south and south wind.
160 what?
Page 160. Top of 160. Who is wise and understandeth this, of which Aldifidius saith, that men and children pass her by daily in the streets and public places, and she is trod into the mire by beasts of burden and cattle. Well, there's two things I want to get out of that passage. One is not so hard to figure out, that this wisdom is rejected. But there's a subtlety in that text which is not so easy to discern, and that's what I'd like to look at. Let me read you her first couple of sentences after that paragraph. The Aldifidius quotation says of this figure that she is trodden into the mire by the ignorant, which means psychologically that the feminine personification of the unconscious is rejected by the prevailing collective views, and with the result that the lapis, the germ of the individuation process, is stifled. Now, that's nothing brilliant there, but everyone follows that, I'm sure. But here's the part that's more subtle. The saying is quoted with extraordinary frequency by the alchemists, and almost always it refers to the stone of the wise, this trodden into the mire. So what she's asking us to think about is that the phrase that the alchemists apply to the goal of their process is the phrase used here to describe Sophia. So that our author obviously identifies wisdom with the lapis. Does that lapis make sense to everybody?
No.
No. Let me just give you a brief description of alchemy. The alchemists started with a piece or pieces of useless material. And I'm making it real basic, but just to get us started. And in that piece or piece of material, they thought there were a whole bunch of constituent parts all gobbledygooked together. And they would describe those as various mythological powers. A king, a queen, Hermes, Athena, whatever language they chose. And as they cooked that piece of material, they thought that those pieces would separate. As they cooked it further, those pieces would come back together, but instead of being in a gobbledygook arrangement, they'd be in a ordered, meaningful, symmetrical relationship. And when that happened, that piece of material would either turn into gold or a magic stone. And the gold would be a special gold which could turn other things into gold. Or that stone would be a magic stone that could heal people or could turn other stones into magic stones. And that word for that stone was lapis. Lapis is Latin for stone. So it means the end of the alchemical process, which we interpret as the central value of your personality. So what we're trying to do in therapy, in other words, is take the mixed up pieces of your life and help you find the meaningful pattern, which, when you understand that, will allow this previously helter-skelter feeling about your life to feel like it's a unified, meaningful experience. That's the lapis. And in this text, the same description is used for Sophia as is applied to the alchemical process. That it's trodden in the mire, rejected. So what that means by implication is that this Sophia encounter is going to lead to an alchemical process. You don't get Sophia on a silver platter. You get Sophia in a mess, and then you have to work on that mess until the redeemed form of what Sophia represents, namely your true self, is present to you. So this text now is going to be a text with two leitmotifs, Sophia and alchemy. We're going to be watching how Sophia approaches, let's say, Thomas Aquinas. And then we're going to see that what gets going in him and what's recorded in these visions is the alchemical process to try to make that experience his own. And that's all implied in that little phrase, which you would skip over if we didn't have something like what I'm trying to point out. Tom?
A little bit about the history stuff. Do we know when we went over Aquinas' biography and stuff, and obviously he was well-read and scholarly and all that, but do we know that he had exposure to alchemical
science? Yeah. He studied with Albertus Magnus.
Oh, that's right.
And he was a big alchemist. And and a cleric as well. Yeah. So what we're assuming is
that... It's not coincidental that the language is used.
It's not coincidental. You can look at it from the point of view of the personalistic influence on his life from Albertus. But what Franz will be saying is all that did was fill up the part of his psyche that wants to express alchemically anyway. So this isn't a conscious replay of alchemical symbolism. This is an unconscious drawing on that process and using some of the language he learned, but it's not something he's created.
I don't think he would have been aware of it anyway, even if he had to study with Magnus. This was something that was the intellectual elite at the time, was current with them, and he would have read it.
Right.
You know, since he was, very intellectually advanced himself.
Right.
Something he would have read anyway.
Right. Yeah, I think he had real intimate connections through a teacher of his in Germany. And remember, even though from our mind today there is an absolute conflict between the alchemists and Christianity. If you really look at what they're saying, they're in conflict. At that time, they didn't see the conflict. So you had many clerics, you know, who were bishops, who were alchemists. These guys were both leaders of the churches and alchemists both. So it's not strange to their mind. It is strange to our mind. And Jung said, if Christ really did bring redemption, why did you need alchemy? That would be his criticism of the fact that people didn't see the contradiction. It's showing that the Christian story needs to be carried on, because very often what's produced in that return when the lapis is finished is Christ. They were trying to produce Christ in that chemical vessel.
I keep hearing you refer to alchemy as something very definite. And I can't help but think that alchemy in ancient Greek times would be different than alchemy in ancient Egyptian times. I mean, those times overlap. And then alchemy in medieval times. I wonder if you took one from one totally different location and different time, if they would even relate to the other. I mean, I'm thinking it would be so.
Well.
I mean, they work with metals. That's the bottom line. They work with metals and.
Sure. The medieval ones studied the Greek and Egyptian ones. So they very much saw themselves in the tradition. There were certainly differences, but there's also a very great similarity. But in any case, when I say alchemy, I mean medieval alchemy. Because it really became refined.
Okay.
It was much more differentiated. Remember the quick history of alchemy? Started in Alexandria in Egypt. You can kind of see the foundation of alchemy is embalming, trying to make an eternal corpse. That got transferred to working with metals to make metals eternal. That was Egypt. The Arabs came in, conquered it, took it to their homeland, kept it alive. When the Crusades came into the East, it came back to Europe at about 1500, I guess. A little bit before, and took a foothold on Europe. So it went from the Hellenistic Egypt, which is Greek in Egypt, to the Muslim countries, and then back to us, which is why it's called alchemic. It's like Al-Qaeda, the same Al. Did you hear about the guy who got arrested? I'll tell you that joke. The guy who got arrested in New York for. It was one of these funny emails somebody sent me. This guy got arrested at JFK for getting on a plane because he was an avid follower of algebra, and he had weapons of math instruction with him, a compass and a ruler. It goes on from there. But alchemy, algebra, they're all Arabic words. Should we have a break?
B, doesn't it?
Right. Mm-hmm. The chemistry.
I think the confusion in the modern, in the typical perception, when you say alchemy to somebody, they know anything about the word at all. They think it's just a bunch of idiots trying to take a dirt and make gold out of it. And there certainly was that aspect.
Yeah. You know,
there certainly was people in medieval times trying to do that. Huge scams were run and everything like that. But then the other end.
That's spiritual dimension.
There's a bit of modern alchemy. It's on TV. It's a tape of the cremains, the diamond out of it, cost $7,000.
Take your human ashes from people who are cremated.
Yeah.
And they take those ashes and they compress them and make a diamond with it.
Oh, grandma.
Beautiful.
Exactly. You wear grandma on your
Let's have a break.
No, but after Thanksgiving, I'm going to go to the diamond.